Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Child Protection in Sport Unit. We're part of the NSPCC and funded by UK Sports Councils. Our work supports organisations to safeguard all children taking part in sport.
Welcome to our Safer Events podcast. My name's Kayla and I'm one of the information officers here at the CPSU, and I'm here today with Michelle North, one of our senior consultants who has been a part of our team since 2013. Michelle takes the lead on our event safeguarding within the team, and we're here today to talk about how to safeguard at sporting events and what to do to make sure you've included everything in your safeguarding policy. So Michelle.
Hi Kayla. I think it's really interesting if we take a minute just to reflect back on our own experience around events and activities or competitions. If we go back to our own childhood, I think all of us will remember that first time we ever went away and what that meant to us. So it kind of drives it home about why this work is really, really key, and we do what we can to make sure young people today go into their events, they have a really positive experience and stay safe while they're there. So if we think back to our own, maybe things weren't quite like they are today, but it's really important that we start thinking about this at an early stage.
Absolutely. So when we're thinking about events, what would you class as an event? Is it anything to do when children are around, or is it a little bit more specific?
I think it is an absolute umbrella term, and it can be anything from an informal, rounders match on a village green to the Olympics. It is an absolute catch-all from those things. It could involve just two teams. It could be a multi-team event. It could be an international event. So when we mean event, it does cover a very broad spectrum of those kind of activities that happen. And in this particular podcast, we're definitely focusing on sport. But actually, it could be anything where young people get together and take part in an activity over a period of time.
Absolutely. And all children have the right to be safe in anything they participate in. So we must make sure that we've got the correct safeguarding in place to ensure their safety. So when we're looking at safeguarding at events, how would you recommend people start that process? What do they need to think about?
I think if I think back on my own experience and some of the pitfalls that people have found themselves in, I think part of the issue sometimes is they don't think about safeguarding early enough. This often is something that they consider once the arrangements have started to take place. So it's really key that when you're deciding to put an event together, whether you are the event organiser or you're a coach taking a group of young people to an event, or you're a chaperone, whatever your role is, think about it at the earliest possible moment, really, because while you're having safeguarding in the back of your head, you're making better decisions that will impact how the well-being of young people, how well they enjoy the event and how safe they remain. So things that we need to think about is the event planning at the time, thinking about risk assessments, things that might need to take place in terms of the venue. But for certain events, there are things that will be additional, like transport or overnight accommodation. And I think one of the issues that some people find is that they use their safeguarding plan that they might have as a club or as a school and think that would fit the bill for an event. And you already have bought in new scenarios that wouldn't be covered within their existing policy, like transport, like overnight accommodation, or supervision ratios in terms of downtime and out of competition time. So it is about thinking prior to the event, all those little things that are unique and exciting at events, but it can be a bit like a pressure cooker. So getting those things right at the very beginning will help you throughout the process.
So when we're looking at preparation, you know, we're looking at, like you said, making good planning time, making sure you have risk assessments, so really having a look at your event, how it's going to be held and what aspects are involved in that. So that's really good information. And we're looking at codes of conduct. We talk about that a lot in safeguarding and making sure that everyone is aware of codes of conduct. So is that something that you would also recommend looking at pre-event?
Absolutely. And think about who you've got at your event. And so there's kind of two parts to this. There's the recruitment and who you've got going to your event. So whether that is staff or volunteers and the roles that they're going to take, but also how you get young people to get to your event. when you started to identify all those different roles and responsibilities, you can then start to think of the different code of conducts. So if I was an athlete at an event, I would be expected to behave in a certain way. If I was a spectator, that might be slightly different. There will be similarities, but there will be distinct differences between those different roles. And your codes of conduct should reflect that. I think some of the time that what doesn't get considered is, if something does happen and someone breaches that code of conduct at an event or a competition, what are you going to do? And if it doesn't link to any type of sanctions or help to get that issue resolved, it's actually not going to help you. So really think about the code of conduct in place, how you communicate that with everybody, so people are really clear about what their expected behaviour would look like, but also understand the risk that they put if they breach any of those. And, you know, there are things like, I don't know, alcohol, say, at events. It's, you know, what's the rule on that, both for adults and anyone else that might be involved? Be very clear about that and what you will do if you come across someone who is drinking while they might be responsible for young people. It is better to have these things in place, agreed and communicated prior to the event, than when you're at the event. It's much harder then to respond to stuff in a clear and consistent way.
And so going on to more generic things like, you know, when we think about safeguarding, we think about keeping children safe, but we need to also think about their well-being. So we're looking at food and water, what needs to be provided, what resources and what things that they have at the venue. We need to think about the weather as well. So these are things as well that you think we should be looking at pre-event?
Absolutely. And the more we know about the young people that are coming out to our event will help us with some of those things. So if we've got young people with dietary needs, or they have certain disabilities or intolerances, we absolutely need to know that prior so that we can make sure that we are providing a safe environment for them. If you know you're going to have an event in the middle of the summer, keep an eye on what the weather's going to do. If you are looking at a very hot day, then order more water, get some sunscreen in, all those kind of things that make sense. Or if you know that there's going to be adverse weather conditions, think about those risk assessments when you're looking at sites around what would happen if it absolutely bucketed of rain in terms of competition at being able to happen, and how would you maintain the safety for the event and the young people there. But also if things get called off, what's the alternatives they could be doing? So if we take a rugby pitch that was waterlogged because of rain and they weren't able to play because it wasn't safe, what alternatives could you have in your back pocket for that group of young people to be doing so that they're not bored or feel like they're not getting the enjoyment out of the event that they maybe could?
And when we're thinking about children and young people's needs, we know that everyone has different needs. So would you agree that pre-event you also need to make sure we have registration, we obtain those that information prior to the event so we can ensure we have things in place while the event's happening for everyone?
That pre-information is absolutely key to maintain that we keep young people safe. If they have pre-existing medical conditions, we need to have a knowledge of that so that we can let first aid know, let key people who are responsible for those young people know. We can make sure the medication is staying safe, all those things. If we don't know that prior to the event, it can make life very, very difficult at the event and obviously make it very unsafe for the young person. So we want to know things about their medical condition. We want to make sure that they've got permission to be at your event. You know, it's important that we talk to parents about what the experience is going to be like for their young people, what they can expect, because we've got duty of care to those young people often during that event. So we need to be clear with parents. And part of that consent is also things around permission to be able to take their photos or their names being put in the results table or a programme and things like that. So we need to have those considerations in terms of consent.
I have to admit, as a mother, I get quite snap happy when my daughter's participating in certain things. So I think that's a good point to talk about permission slips when thinking about photography and who you can and can't take photos of. So how would you identify people who do not want their photos taken?
This is a really tricky one. It depends on the size of your event. It is really clear that people have the option not to have their photo taken, and often we will give them a bright band to wear around their wrist, and we will tell the official firm, the photographers of the event, that those are the people that they shouldn't be taking photos of. And then during the review of those photos, people will be making sure that none of those children are captured. the reality of it is, in today's world, like you say, we've got parents with cameras in their pockets all the time and young people with cameras in their pockets all the time. It is very difficult to police that. So what we need to be better at is, how do we communicate what images should be taken and how they should be shared? So it's absolutely right that you would want to take pictures of your child at their event or activity. You should be celebrating their successes and those milestones in their life. But actually, how are we explaining to parents that you should be taking pictures of your own child? And if you are putting them on social media, that you're only tagging your family and not someone else's child, or that they're positive images that you're putting up? So I don't know, say it was a cycling event and there was a crash, as you know it happens where you've got lots of people on cycles. You wouldn't want those kind of images of your children out in the public, so be mindful of those kind of images. And I think, what, as organisers and as safeguarding professionals, we've got to get better about how we communicate those nuances around photography, about good positive images of young people.
And I think lastly, when we're thinking about pre-event, we need to look at recruitment. So how do we make sure that we're recruiting safely?
I think this is a really tricky one for a lot of people, and that just is across the board depending on the size of your event. I think it's always really tricky. A lot of these events would never take place if it wasn't for volunteers giving up their time, their expertise to make sure these events happen. And although we are grateful for those numbers that the events happen, we need to not ignore that we should be following safer recruitment procedures for those people. So if they are coming to coach or train at an event or to run a particular activity, are they qualified to do so? Are they insured? Do they have the right criminal records check that's appropriate for them? And the same with volunteers. What's the role that they're going to be doing? Do we need to be making sure that they have criminal records checks? If we can't be doing that, what else can we be doing? We should be taking references for people. Are they the right person for that particular role? It's about making sure that, obviously, first and foremost, that young people are safe, but it's also making sure that those volunteers are getting something out of that event as well. Because absolutely. So we need to make sure we've got the right people in the right roles, and a lot of that is around safer recruitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And just lastly, when we're thinking about safeguarding and getting all that safeguarding information out there, you know, when we're thinking about larger events where there's lots of different activities going on all at the same time and there's a safeguarding concern, how would you recommend people being able to gather that information and get it to, you know, the safeguarding lead officer at that event, or to medics, or the appropriate person?
I think it depends on the kind of role it is. The information should be easy to find, whether it's on people's lanyard, whether it's on the communication beforehand. I know at some events they have it on A-frames around welfare teams and things like that. So it does depend on the structure of your event and what's in place. But we should be making it easy for people to raise a concern over tannoys. I think what we have got to move away from is sending people information and just assuming they read it and take that information in. I think that's a great start. I don't think it's strong enough. So we need to be thinking about other ways we get information across. And I think what you alluded to there, which I think is really, really important, that some events won't have a discreet safeguarding lead for their event. And so one of the things to consider is about, if something does happen, how does that person build capacity to respond to something when they've got 8 other million hats at that event that they might have to do? So this goes into the pre-event planning, to making sure that people are clear what their roles and responsibilities are, and there is a process to respond to things that mean that safety is kind of paramount for those young people.
Absolutely. So pre-event looking at safeguarding is really important to get started early, so it seems, because there's lots to cram in there and make sure that you're ticking all those boxes and getting everything ready to carry on with the event. I suppose we need to look at things happening during the event as well. So when we were talking in the pre-event, we were talking about getting safeguarding information and across to the safeguarding lead. But if there's emerging themes, would it be safe to say that it would be quite a good idea to have perhaps like a little suggestion box or something, looking at maybe the less serious emerging themes, and how you would safeguard during the event, those sort of situations.
I think it's a really good idea. I think kind of in the lead up to the event, you want to be raising safeguarding with everybody that comes along, so that as soon as your event starts, people already know that safeguarding is a key priority at your event. And what are the kind of things you want to get raised? Because I think what you raise there is really important, that we're not just talking about abuse and blue flashing lights, scary stuff. We are talking about those wider welfare concerns that can emerge at events. Well, they can emerge anywhere, but at events, because of that pressure cooker type of scenario, can come up quite early on in an event. So we want to make it clear to people that we want to know about everything. And when you kind of build that in, you are going to have conversations with people at an early stage. So there needs to be a way to kind of triage those, to, like you say, build in, if there are emerging themes, what can be done. So say there was a lack of water at one part of the event and people were getting overheated and things like that. Actually, those concerns would come through. You could then put on tannoy and get water shipped over from a different side of the site, depending on the size of your event. It is about communication and how that is shared.
So when we're looking at events, we're at the event's happening, and there's a concern to report, who would be the person you would need to report those concerns to?
I think this is a really important conversation that has to happen. So most of the key people at an event will have that knowledge and information. So whether it's a coach or a team manager that's come with the young people, they will know how to report concerns. During the event, there will be other people there that you may not have had access to prior to the event, as part of the pre-event planning. So people like security maybe, or the medical team. So it's really important that somebody briefs them around their safeguarding responsibility, because often they're the eyes and ears around some of those concerns that might come up. It's very unusual for them to come up as a direct disclosure or someone telling you. It's often what people see or hear. So we need to make sure that we are briefing people that it is everyone's responsibility to report on a concern or a worry, and make it as easy as possible for them to do it. Make sure that they know who they're reporting it to, and be really clear about what they can expect in return. So it could be that at some events, depending on the size, they might have a welfare tent where there's somebody there that will can respond to things. At some of the bigger events, there will be a whole safeguarding team where people can call on. But it's really clear that regardless of the size of your event, that there is a first port of call that someone can phone, even if you're not quite sure if it's a concern, you just want to talk something over. So anybody can have responsibility reporting concern. The key bit from a safeguarding perspective, an organiser's perspective, is how do you let people know that that's their responsibility?
Absolutely. Okay, I mean, when we're looking at concerns and reporting concerns, what type of concerns would you recommend people report? I mean, if it's when you're thinking about big events, there's lots going on. Do people really want to hear about the trivial stuff, or do you only want to hear about the more serious cases?
I think from my perspective, the more you hear about, the better you can do your safeguarding at your event. So I want to know absolutely everything, down to the fact that someone doesn't like what's in the sandwiches. It might be that you don't do anything with it, but you're starting to build a picture of what's going on, and you can keep an eye on it. So if that report about that young person who hasn't eaten their lunch because they didn't like what's in their sandwich and they've still not eaten at dinner, actually you are starting to get more of a worry around what's going on for that young person. And the more we know about it, the earlier we can get in and make a change, maybe get some different food ordered for that young person, so we're heading off a problem before it becomes one. I think sometimes people do wait because they're not sure that it's a concern or that it's something to worry about. And I think that's key about the adults that are involved in event, having an understanding of their young people, because they will know what's normal and what's not, and if things are slightly different. And there needs to be an element of trust that they can report concerns and know they're going to get a measured, confidential response to those concerns being raised. Because at the end of the day, it goes back to creating a safe, enjoyable space for young people to build those memories in their life to come.
So we want to be reporting anything from the small trivial stuff to the big, major, serious concerns, so we can get a better picture of what's happening at our event. That sounds great. Okay, so, I mean, let's get to the fun stuff. We all know that when you're at an event like this, the sun is shining, you're in the middle of summer, everyone's having a good time, the urge does come to have a little drink here and there. But obviously when there's children around, we have to make sure we're keeping everything safe. So what would you say to the event organiser or the safeguarding lead looking after events around alcohol consumption within adults specifically? Because children, we know under 18 shouldn't be drinking anyway. So what would you recommend for that situation?
I think it depends on the size of the event and the nature of the event. For ease and my experience, I would love to be able to say make it a dry event and no one can have alcohol because it will make life easier. But I'm also a realist and know that that's not feasible. But if you are responsible for young people during the course of that event, and that includes overnight, in downtime, then actually you shouldn't be drinking alcohol while you've got responsibility for those children. Because if anything was to happen and you had to make a decision or you had to drive them somewhere, you know, you would not want your decision making to be impaired because you've had a couple of drinks. So I would say for people who have direct responsibility for young people at an event or an activity, then absolutely, I think there should be a dry event for those people. I think when we think about the smaller and formal events, if we're thinking about spectators and things like that, it's harder to kind of maintain that ethos for events like that. But we should be giving a good example for our young people. So you wouldn't want people to be drunk in terms of around those young people. So, you know, maybe that's part of your code of conduct that we mentioned before around the image and the example that we're setting our young people. So I'm realistic and I know people are going to have a drink and have a really nice time. And I've often been called the fun police on this matter. So I do understand the difficulty of that. But if anything was to happen, you want to maintain that level thinking, that clear thinking. So I would avoid alcohol if you are in charge of young people.
And this leads into my next question, because when we're looking at overnight stays, sometimes sporting events last for 2, 3, 4 days, or you need to go, you need to travel to get there, and that means that you need to stay overnight. There is temptation there, isn't there, as adults? You know, the kids are tucked up in bed and you're just sort of relaxing now of a stressful day and it's been very busy. And you do want to relax with that alcohol, but obviously we're saying that it's really not a good idea if you have that responsibility, because, you know, midnight someone knocks on your door with a safeguarding concern. You don't want to have any of your decision-making impaired, like you said. And so when we're looking at overnight stays, what sort of safeguarding considerations need to be made when we're talking about that?
And this goes back to the need for pre-planning, because if people are using their existing safeguarding policy for clubs or whatever it is, that's not going to be covered. So if we're talking about overnight stays, have it agreed prior. Is there a curfew for those young people? Depending on the age of the children and the environment that you're in, are they allowed to go off? You know, are they allowed to go off in pairs? Do they have to stay as a team with an adult? What does supervision look like out of competition? And I think sometimes the problems that people run into at events is that's not been agreed prior to the event. So when it comes to overnight, I absolutely understand that if you are a team manager and a coach and you've been with those young people since 7 o'clock in the morning, since they got up, all throughout their competition, and it's 10 o'clock at night and you're exhausted, I absolutely get that, but you still have responsibility for those young people. So be really clear about what that means. So it means you can't nip off and go and get a coffee with your friend, because you will have a number of young people who are unsupervised. It could be that you talk to other team managers and you share that responsibility, so you can get a little bit of downtime. I'm not saying you need to be super glued to young people, but be really clear around what that supervision will look like. An overnight's really key because we want to make sure that young people are safe in their rooms, in their own rooms, not in each other's rooms, and so that they don't come up to any harm during that process or during that period.
Absolutely. And it's also looking at, I think, the hotel or where you're staying, how safe that is, if they can easily, you know, get out or get into the building. And it's also looking at how would you check on the young people during the night. Is that something that you need to do?
I think that's really, really important what you've said there. And that, again, goes back to what you asked me around consent. So if you've got a young person who may be a wheelchair user, and there's a fire alarm in the night, is there an accessible way out? How many evac chairs are there? Or if you've got a young person who might be deaf or hard of hearing, is there a way of getting them to know that the alarm's gone off? So it's really key that those people who have responsibility for those children know that and are around to respond to concern. Because if that young that's needed and the adult's gone off, you can see how something awful could happen.
And this ties back to making sure when you're looking at the event pre-event, you're doing risk assessments on every aspect of your event, especially overnight, because we want to make sure those children are safe during the night as well. And so just tying in with emergencies in the night, that's obviously something we need to talk about. So we're talking about fire alarms, but also things like if there's an injury. I mean, kids like to jump in the bed, for instance, and they fall off. I mean, what we need to be looking at that, I imagine, and doing risk assessments for that as well.
Absolutely. You know, people get ill. There are a number of things that can happen at night. So as an organisation, if it's an overnight event, there should be arrangements in place in terms of medical support. If it's urgent enough, then obviously phone 99 or 111, depending on the nature of the concern, and get support. But that the person who has responsibility for those young people, that should be really clear to them. Is there a medical team that's on standby that they can use? Or isn't there? You know, does the hotel that they might be staying in or the university accommodation that they might be staying in have those things available? Or are they staying in tents, you know, in terms of in the middle of the field, in the middle of nowhere? It's best to have that stuff prior to events so you know what would happen if something like that arose. So it's really key that we know how to get medical support. Even things down to, say, you're in a hotel room and there's a leak. It's really basic things that can happen, but what's the response process for that?
And so looking at all types of events, and we're looking at maybe people who have wandered into the venue, wandered onto the pitch, who shouldn't be there. I mean, what type of things do we, when looking at risk assessments, do we need to have in consideration for those types of situations?
So it's really key we know who is at our event. So some things that help with that are kit. So if someone's got a particular kit on, you know they're part of your event. Or they have lanyards with the fact that they are part of that event, so you've got an idea. But it's also being clear around the security of that event. You know, sometimes things happen in a public place and there's very little that we can do in terms of stopping the public being there, but what we can do is put signage up. We can talk to people. If we see somebody who we're not sure whether they should be there or not, is actually just ask them, is there anything we can help you with? It's not about being confrontational, it's not about creating a problem, but it's making sure that the environment is safe for our young people. So if you are a part of the event, what makes you part of the event? Is there any kind of identification that will help with that? And if not, how do we equip people to feel confident enough to be able to go up to somebody and say, can I help you? I see that you're not wearing a lanyard. Are you part of this event? And talk to them about why we're asking, because it is an event involving young people. So most people are normally quite aware around why we're asking those questions.
So it's check and challenge, I suppose.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and so, you know, we're at an event and we're looking at changing rooms. I mean, we just got to make sure that there's, you know, well-equipped changing areas for young people. We can't have them just undressing in the middle of a pitch, I suppose.
No, and there are some sports that is more difficult to kind of maintain than others because of the nature of the sport. They're quite used to getting changed at the sidelines much more freely. But, you know, it goes back to your pre-planning. If you are in a public leisure centre and there are public changing rooms, are there a part of the changing rooms you can board up or kind of section off that would just be for your young people? Is there a way of making sure that people don't have access to it at certain times, so only your young people will be there. It's about making sure they're safe. But the pre-planning is really key. So if you've got young people who might need help being changed, how's that going to be done during your event? Will they be able to access the bathrooms and the changing rooms if they have a sport wheelchair that might be slightly wider than your average wheelchair? These are part of your pre-planning, your risk assessments. And you know, if we are looking at trans young people, how do we make sure that they feel safe at their event? And that's why having this information beforehand makes life easier, because all that will be agreed, it will be communicated to the people involved, so it shouldn't be a big deal for that young person, and they will feel included and safe, as will everyone else.
Absolutely. And I think we touched on my next question a little earlier in the podcast, but as we were saying, everyone has phones now with cameras in it, so, and we know that a lot of young people now have mobile phones, so I think when it comes to changing rooms, we just need to make sure as well, I imagine, that we think about signages for those changing rooms saying that you cannot take photographs within this area, etc. Was that something that you would agree with?
It is absolutely clear that changing rooms should be a no phone zone for anybody. And there's certain sports that have that. So if we think about swimming, there's no phones on the side of the pool, but it actually goes to changing rooms as well. I think some of the best practice I've seen has been around people using masking tape to be really clear about where your phones are not allowed to be out. So people have done like a meter outside of a changing room, or they've been around where the team manager is giving their team a pep talk. So it's like, these are no phone zones, because that's where the risk can be, particularly with young people taking selfies and taking pictures of each other. We do not want images like that of them in the changing room being taken.
And I think that's a minor detail that we need to be mindful of, that there are these little things that perhaps you have in place at your club, or but you wouldn't actually necessarily remember to take them with you to the event. So that's really important, I think, that we make sure that we're remembering to take those little details along with your event with you, because actually they can have quite catastrophic consequences if we don't remember those things. So that's all in the risk assessment pre-event, and thinking about what is included. And when we're talking about change rooms as well, it's important that when we're looking at venues to hold sporting events, we're making sure that we're finding somewhere that can cater for all these things, that can cater for change rooms, and that have areas specific to your event that is going to be useful to you. There's no point in having a football match on a cricket pitch that it's just not going to work. So you need to make sure you have those things. And I think lastly, when we're thinking about events and what's happening during your sporting event, we want to look at first aid. So making sure there are medics and things on site. And does it depend on the size of the event, how many medics you have, or what first aid is?
It absolutely depends on the size of the event and the riskiness of the activity. So if you are playing tiddlywinks, the risk of a serious injury is probably quite low. But if you're playing maybe a contact sport, actually the risks are much higher. So it's about having that risk assessment of what do we need. And then you're thinking about the numbers of young people involved, having a look at how do we make sure that they've got access to medical support across the whole event. And also the size of the event. So if you're over a very large area, there's no point having one ambulance at the other side, and actually a lot of the activity is a mile away down the road. It's about really being clear about what do we need. So make an assessment about at what point do we just need basic first aid on hand? Are there times where we need something a little bit more serious, and or do we need a St John's ambulance or more so on hand in case there's a much more serious injury? And that does reflect back that pre-planning and thinking about safeguarding at that very first stage will help you with this.
And it's really important to remember to make sure that all your first aiders who are going have an up-to-date first aid certificate. So that's also something at the pre-planning stage that I would imagine you would need to keep in mind. So we're looking now, we've talked about pre-event, we've talked about what we do during the event, and now we're looking at post-event. I suppose a lot of people would think the event's over, so you don't need to think about safeguarding, but actually it is quite important. And could you tell me why?
I think there's a lot of time that you get post-event. As soon as the event is done, you're one, exhausted. Hopefully it's all gone well and it's all been positive for everyone involved, but you are just glad it's done and you can move on. But the reality of it is we need to take a minute. We need to take some time to reflect on what has gone well, maybe what hasn't gone so well. So start looking at those reporting forms. We talked about earlier about the need for raising concerns at a lower level, because then we'll get a picture about what was the experience like for young people. I think one of the things that you can learn is, you know, if people are saying that they're bored out of competition, well, when you come to plan your next event, then actually one of the things you might look at is what activities or opportunities are there for young people out of competition to make sure that they're not bored. When young people are bored, this is generally when things can go wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about reflecting on what's happened so that you can put that in your planning for the next event that you have to make sure it is safer, more enjoyable for everyone involved. And I don't think people give themselves enough time to reflect on that, to celebrate what's gone well, but learn from what maybe hasn't gone as well.
And it'll only make your job easier if you're an event planner. If you're looking at post-event, what did work well and what didn't, it's going to make your job easier the next event you're organising to know how best to safeguard. Okay, so I think what we can take from this podcast and the information that you've talked about today, Michelle, is that pre-planning events is absolutely key to ensuring the success of any event of any size. But what would be your three top tips that you would want to give?
I think if there was three top tips about safeguarding events, it would be making sure that you have a robust safeguarding policy in place that reflects the event that you're talking about and that that's clearly communicated to everybody who needs to know about it. I think the second bit is around having codes of conduct. So that's understanding who is at your event and making sure that people understand acceptable behaviour and what people do and don't want at their event. And then I think the third thing is having very clear reporting procedures and understanding of what will happen if you raise a concern. I think if we can concentrate on those things as a start, I think you can make sure that you have a much safer event.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for today. Like Michelle mentioned earlier on in the podcast, we do have a whole host of information on our website to ensuring safer events. It's called the Safe Sport Events Tool, and you'll find a link to that below on our page here. And don't forget, if you do have any questions at all, you're more than welcome to get in contact with the CPSU or the NSPCC helpline, and details of how to contact either of those are also below. We hope you take all the information you need from this podcast and have a really great event. Thank you so much, Michelle, for your time today.
Thank you, Kayla.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this Child Protection in Sport Unit podcast. If you're looking for more information and resources on safeguarding children in sport, please visit our website at thecpsu.org.uk.